This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Joseph Stewart. Today on the New Books Network, we'll be discussing Brent M. Rogers' Buffalo Bill and the Mormons from the University of Nebraska Press, published in 2024. In this never-before-told history of Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, Brent Rogers presents the intersections in the epic histories of William F. Buffalo Bill Cody and the Latter-day Saints from 1846 through 1917. In Cody's autobiography, he claimed to have been a member of the U.S. Army wagon train that was burned by the Saints during the Utah War of 1857-58. Less than 20 years later, he began his stage career and gained notoriety by performing anti-Mormon dramas. By early 1900, he actively recruited Latter-day Saints to help build infrastructure and encourage growth in the region surrounding his town of Cody, Wyoming. In Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, Rogers unravels this history and the fascinating trajectory that took America's most famous celebrity from foe to friend of the Latter-day Saints. In doing so, the book demonstrates how the evolving relationship between Cody and the Latter-day Saints can help readers better understand the political and cultural perceptions of Mormons and the American West. Dr. Brent Rogers, welcome to the New Books Network. And in picking up Buffalo Bill and the Mormons, I immediately thought of your first book, which is entitled Unpopular Sovereignty, Mormons and the Federal Management of Early Utah Territory, which examines the role of popular sovereignty, government authority, and the settlement of the American West. How did the research and ideas that you share in your first book shape the research that went into Buffalo Bill and the Mormons?
Well, my first book looks at that history surrounding the coming of the Utah War. There's a lot that leads up to the coming of the army in 1857, the Utah Territory, and there is a great story around that lead up. And then there's the story of the Utah War itself. And then there's the story of the aftermath and all of the political, gendered and racial dynamics that went along with aspects coming to the war, the prosecution of the war, and then the aftermath are discussed in my first book. But in that moment when the Utah War is really getting going and the army is en route and Latter-day Saints are actively trying to prevent the army from entering Utah territory, there's a lot of really interesting military history that is going on there. And in that time frame, there was a big effort by Latter-day Saint militiamen to raid and burn grasses and otherwise halt the army from entering Utah territory. And that made a lot of national news at the time. It was demonstrable proof of rebelliousness of Latter-day Saints. And so it was something that was talked about a lot. Well, one of the things that I found as I was researching that episode was something that I had actually come across earlier in reading Buffalo Bill Cody's autobiography, in which he has the episode of Lott Smith's raid on the wagon train in very vivid detail. And he claims to have been on the supply trains that were supplying the U.S. Army through the Russell, Majors, and Waddell Company. I always found that to be curious. Why, you know, what was he really there? And if he was, how does his experience match up with the other historical records? And if he wasn't, why would he add that in his autobiography? There have been several scholars who have tried to, you know, tackle this in some way, shape, or form. Louis Warren writes about it in his book, Buffalo Bill's America. A researcher named John Gray, who published a couple of articles decades ago, William McKinnon, who's written a lot about the Utah War, all said this is mythologized. And something that folks who know Buffalo Bill Cody's history will know, that, you know, there are portions of his autobiography that are myths. It was image making, trying to create a persona, but not all of it was. You know, there's truth in his autobiography as well. And so that always made me curious. I didn't write anything about this for my first book, but I always was curious about that question. What was Buffalo Bill's participation in the Utah War, if any? And in what ways was his claiming of that important for his persona in the 1870s and beyond? The other thing that I'd say about the first book is that it helped me understand the factors that shaped Cody's world and his interactions with Latter-day Saints, you know, understanding how the Latter-day Saints were perceived in 1850s and 1860s and 1870s America. So this is understanding the world that Cody grew up in, giving sort of a framework for understanding his world, the importance of understanding those twin relics of barbarism, polygamy, and slavery, which are major factors in the 1850s, 1860s, and then the second relic of barbarism, polygamy, into the 1870s and 1880s. And these are things that are very much discussed in the media, in politics, this effort at the federal government's effort to manage the West as it grows. The impact of the federal government in the West was also part of that first story that overlays Cody's story. And so I would say those are the major ways in which my first book shaped my thinking and my desire to understand Buffalo Bill Cody and his connection with Latter-day Saints more.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. I especially love you connecting your work to Louis Warren's and Bill McKinnon's, among others, in thinking about how scholarship grows on top of each other, how one takes arguments and examines the same primary sources and can come to different conclusions. I'm also interested, too, in the way that Buffalo Bill makes his participation in the Utah War a central part of his life story. To me, at least, it functions like a prism onto which he is projecting the rest of his life. How and why do you think that he did that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a complicated question. And I'll talk about two parts of this that I hope I connect appropriately enough. But I think that the autobiography is the first time that he talks about his participation in the Utah War. And let's take out of the question whether he was there or not. Like, we'll just stick with 1877 and the question of why it would be in his autobiography and very prominently written about. And I think it speaks to the era in which the autobiography was released. There's the very public John D. Lee trials for the Mountain Meadows Massacre that have just happened. There's the very public Ann Eliza Webb Young, Brigham Young divorce that is very highly publicized. All these things speaking to the horrors of Latter-day Saints and Mormonism and that faith in American culture, and how and why Utah and its people should be regulated by federal legislation and by cultural norms and these kind of things. And so I think you see Buffalo Bill playing into that, being on the right side of the equation. He's fighting against the Mormons, and right, he's part of the U.S. Army that's going out to quash a supposed Mormon rebellion. And that would have been seen in a very positive light by the American audience consuming that. And I would say beyond an American audience, especially as Buffalo Bill moves his act overseas, British audiences were very anti-Mormon as well and would have seen positive lights in that. So that it's American and European audiences that would have been very much understanding what Buffalo Bill is trying to get across in his idea of protecting people against a Mormon menace. And so there's also this idea of protection of home. And Louis Warren's done a really amazing job of writing about this in his works on Buffalo Bill. And I think that Cody, as this protector of the American home against this threat, is a major part of why the Mormons play a key role in him talking about being a part of the Utah War, because then he can be seen in that light. There is a moment in American culture and American theater that is very much into realism in the late 1870s and into 1880s. And Buffalo Bill is seen as this very authentic character. And so this would feed that image and that perception of him as this true American protector of the proper American home, a monogamous home and Protestant Christian home that would feed into that. Now, the second part of this is that he maintains this story. Again, whether it's completely fictitious and him just adding himself into the narrative to be this prominent American man and protector, or because it becomes part of his persona so much that it just becomes how he talks about it. But when he meets with a group of Latter-day Saints in early 1900, he's spinning stories about his time with Johnston's army and the Utah War and what it was like wintering at Fort Bridger and, you know, eating mule meat and these kind of things. And so he sticks to the story, whether that means or is proof that he was there, or that he's just embraced his persona so much that he just talks about it like it happened. I don't know. And that's the part that I haven't been able to totally figure out. There's no good evidence to say that he was there with the army in 1857. And you can't definitively say that he wasn't. But there is something interesting about him holding fast to that story and saying it over and over again that maybe he bought into his story is so much that just became who he said he was. And what's interesting about that 1900 meeting is that the Latter-day Saints that were there were just enthralled by it, soaking up the stories and asking him about what it was like to fight against their forebears and these kind of things. And so there's a reconciliation that has happened by that point from the Latter-day Saint side of things. And a lot of that would have to do with Cody's celebrity, at this point would be my guess.
I think that naturally leads into another question that I had, which is that Buffalo Bill and then Latter-day Saints or Mormons occupy very different ideas about what a man should be or what a man should not be. So conceptions of manhood and masculinity. So Buffalo Bill is this rugged frontiersman defending the home, but also this icon of white masculinity. Could you contrast that with how many Latter-day Saints were imagined to be in the United States at this time?
Yeah, the contrast is pretty stark in these early decades of, as Buffalo Bill is especially gaining notoriety and fame as that archetypical Western man, you know, very strong, handsome, intelligent, independent person who's willing to go on the front lines to, as you know, the saying would have been, extend American civilization further west, right? So he's this exemplar of what white American manhood looks like at the time. And that example only grows, I think, as he becomes more famous. Latter-day Saint men are seen more in like this form of a creature. There's images of them being octopus. There's images of them being, you know, snakes. There's images of them being these very sullen, creepy looking guys who are trafficking women into white sexual slavery, almost demonic in some ways, right? To contrast what was good and right and proper for American men to do and what was seen as quite the opposite, wanting to control and traffic women. And just these portrayals, the visual images are very, very different. You know, you could look at a picture of a Buffalo Bill Cody and a Mormon man of the time, and not just not a photograph, but like an artist rendering, you would tell immediately who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. That idea of what the Western man as this archetypical figure of manhood in the late 19th century only becomes solidified as Cody's celebrity grows and as the nation as a whole is looking to the West as a place to heal after the Civil War, to grow, there is something about the West that becomes increasingly important to the country's growth, both, you know, economically and politically, but also culturally. And that Western man only grows in its significance. And so as the Latter-day Saints are creating a productive land in the West, they actually start to demonstrate a blueprint for what success, particularly economic success, could look like. They're still seen as very suspect in terms of their home and marital situations. But as 1890 comes and Wilford Woodruff, who was then the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, announces there would be no more new plural marriages, public perception starts to soften a little bit. And I think it softens a lot because of what the Mormons were doing in terms of building in the West. They have created, and I'll share with you real quick something that Cody, he writes about what the Mormons are doing in the West as he's looking to build up his own Western town that he names after himself of Cody, Wyoming. He wrote to a land speculator. He says that the possibilities of the new region, I have no fears, are as grand as any which have followed other pioneers in the older Western states. We have only to look at what the Mormons have done in the Great Salt Lake Valley, which at the time of its settlement was the most desolate of deserts. They have made it blossom as the rose, and today there is no more prosperous and wealthy state on the continent than Utah. And so he himself, the archetype, the exemplar of American manhood, is saying, hey, look at these folks have the blueprint. They have the model, and we need to look at what they've done to create prosperous settlements in the West. And so you have the Latter-day Saints growing in esteem and growing more into that model of what the Western man is to become, which is a tamer of quote unquote wild spaces.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating study. And what I love in your book, Buffalo Bill and the Mormons from University of Nebraska Press, is thinking about the ways that these opposites that are literally on the opposite side of battlefields that are defined as opposites in terms of what a white man should be like ultimately converge in the late 19th and early 20th century as Buffalo Bill Cody and the Latter-day Saints come together as business partners. So could you explain the circumstances? You've spoken about this a little bit, but just to refresh us on how Buffalo Bill and Latter-day Saint leadership came together to settle the Bighorn Basin in Wyoming.
There develops this shared language of Westernness. And that's seen, it doesn't just happen, you know, overnight, right? We're talking about this shift, this contrast from Cody and the Saints as diametrically opposed in the way they're viewed, to sharing this language of Westernness, Western man, of pioneer. And that happens over, you know, over a period of time. And a couple of the junction points in which this really, really takes off is in 1892. There is a growth in looking at what tourist opportunities might happen in Western spaces. And Buffalo Bill is especially interested in going to the Grand Canyon and take some of his British friends on a trip through there. And somehow he gets talking with a Latter-day Saint businessman who owned land in that region named John Young. And John gets with another Latter-day Saint man named Junius Wells, and essentially kind of like, I don't know if he hired him, there's no economic paper trail, but somehow it gets him to agree to lead Cody and his group of friends on a trip from Chicago down to Flagstaff, Arizona, and then from the south rim to the north rim of the Grand Canyon, and then through some Latter-day Saint towns in Utah, namely Kanab and Richfield, and then up to Salt Lake City, where he introduces Buffalo Bill to the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that's, at least in my research, kind of the first time that Buffalo Bill is in a very close proximity, a very, you know, if you will, an intimate space with Latter-day Saints. He gets to know Latter-day Saints on the ground rather than just what the perception of them is in media and in books and newspaper articles and so on. And he has a pretty good time on this trip. You know, Junius Wells writes about some of their exploration in his journal, which was a great resource for me to understand this series of events that brought Cody all the way out to Utah. And then after this trip, Buffalo Bill is interviewed by the Washington Post about what he was doing in the Grand Canyon and in Utah. And he has nothing but very positive things to say about the Latter-day Saints and about what he observed in Utah, the beauties of the region and the Grand Canyon. He's very high on Latter-day Saints, and this sort of marking the first time that he has public praise for the Latter-day Saints for Utah. And he sees firsthand all these settlements from, you know, northern Arizona up to Salt Lake City that are thriving. And so that letter that I read earlier was from 1898. So you look at the next 6 years and how he continues to gain more knowledge about Latter-day Saints and what they are doing in the West, and seeing the model by which they are growing settlements in this arid space gives him a hope. And as I suggested, kind of a blueprint for how to make these lands, these arid spaces, very productive lands. And, you know, Buffalo Bill's a businessman of sorts at the same time as he's a showman. And he sees this as a business opportunity to do business with the Latter-day Saints. As he's trying to develop his town of Cody, Wyoming, there's a lot of struggles with building an irrigation canal, struggles with getting settlers. By 1899, there's an observation that the town of Cody has less than 50 settlers. And so for a town that had been established a few years earlier, that wasn't a lot. And so his town was struggling, and he knew that if he could get some people there to build some infrastructure, he could grow this place that he found to be sort of this pioneer's paradise. And so he, with his business partner, George Beck, reach out to some Latter-day Saints to see if they would be interested in doing some business. And at the same time, the Saints are looking for their own opportunities. There's need for growth. Some of the better lands, agricultural lands in Utah, were taken up. And so maybe some more opportunities to allow people to go in and colonize this new space and sort of be on the ground in a new area of growth. And so they get about 100 families, Latter-day Saint families that are interested, but they have to have a place to go. And so that's where this meeting in February of 1900, Abraham Woodruff, who was a son of the church president, Wilford Woodruff, and who was an apostle of the church, leads a group of Latter-day Saints up to go meet with Cody up near his hometown. And that's where that meeting took place. And after, you know, Cody regales them with some of his Western exploits and his tales of the Utah War, he makes them an offer. And he says, look, I have, and by this point, Cody had accumulated just probably hundreds of thousands of acres of land and water rights up in the region. And so he, for lack of a better phrase, kind of owns the area. And so he says he's going to offer these Saints free land and free water rights if they'll come and build some irrigation infrastructure and demonstrate what this place could be. Once there's an agreement that's made and he does relinquish those rights and the Saints start moving people up, he is immediately using Latter-day Saint settlement as a means to try to encourage other settlers to come. He uses it as means to try to encourage the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad to build their railroad line, which they were really hesitant on about where it would go, but to build that through Cody, Wyoming, so that it would come and serve his town. And it was after the Saints settled there that the railroad executive said, yeah, we probably ought to do this. Then they hire Latter-day Saints to build the railroad. So you have Latter-day Saints that are building these major pieces of critical infrastructure in Northwest Wyoming, the irrigation and the railroad, at least on the surface, that becomes mutually beneficial.
Well, Dr. Rogers, thank you so much for sharing information from your book, Buffalo Bill and the Mormons. If students are listening to this, what big picture ideas would you hope that readers would take away from your book?
There are many layers to the story. And I think there's different ways to engage with it and to appreciate what's happening. There are the individual stories and some really fascinating dynamics of, you know, Buffalo Bill's history and his relationship with Latter-day Saints, which has never really fully been told in historiography. And then on the other side, you can understand sort of the group level interesting dynamics of growth and evolution of Latter-day Saints and these junction points and how they kind of shape each other in different ways. There is a public versus private understanding of what is happening in a public perception in the public sphere, and then what is happening in private and on the ground, and how those private things can help change the public narrative, you know, that shapes the relationships and shapes the perception. As Buffalo Bill gets to know on a private level Latter-day Saints and how he talks about them publicly. And then also how some of the private business dealings between Buffalo Bill and the Saints are personally aggravating to Buffalo Bill, but he continues to laud them publicly. There's this great visit that he makes to Salt Lake City in 1902 and just has nothing but praise to say about Latter-day Saints and their work ethic, and the people are wonderful. And Buffalo Bill was a very generous person, both in his public esteem and in wanting to see equity for people. And he does that a lot with his public commentary. But, you know, there's private things going on that are bubbling beneath the surface that are challenging and conflicting. And I think it just shows that there's a very human dynamic to understanding how Buffalo Bill is dealing with all of interactions that he's having with Latter-day Saints, and how he's growing as a person, and how his understanding of situations, you know, it's not just about his own self-interest at times, and at other times it is. There's insights into about 60 years of political, cultural, economic, and even environmental history about the U.S. and the U.S. West, and understanding these ideas of manhood and masculinity. There's a lot anyone, if they're really interested in kind of looking at these different layers. And I guess maybe, this is kind of like a morality tale in some ways, but I see the history of Buffalo Bill and the Mormons as storytelling, this effort at telling and listening to one another's stories. As you experience people and as you learn about them and as you gain knowledge of the people for who they are, and you really get to know them on that level, there's this, sort of the story of overcoming, whether it's overcoming early prejudices or if it's a story of overcoming narratives about yourself through continuing to, you know, this may be on the side of like a group perception of Mormons, overcoming how people think about you to just continue to do what you're doing and ultimately be seen for the positive influence that they were or that they could be. So there's maybe a few different big picture things along those lines that I think are interesting.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. Knowing that you just finished this project and may not have anything quite yet, what are you planning to research for your next project?
I think I'm going to enjoy this one for a little while, just to enjoy that it's finished and that folks are hopefully enjoying it and understanding more about Buffalo Bill and understanding more about Latter-day Saint history. My kids have sort of grown up with Buffalo Bill, vacations to Laramie, Wyoming, and Cheyenne, Wyoming, Denver, Colorado. Took them on a trip to the north rim of the Grand Canyon so they could see where Buffalo Bill hiked in 1892. And I do the work that I do here is kind of like on the side of my job. And so I think for my kids' sake that maybe I'll just enjoy this one a little bit. A scholar always has a curious mind, and surely something will come up that will catch my interest, and I'll be getting back to vacations that are actually research travel.
Well, again, the name of the book is Buffalo Bill and the Mormons by Brent M. Rogers. Thanks, Dr. Rogers, for stopping by the New Books Network.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.